do whatever you want.
Our meeting will come to order, please. Members, this is the 13th of 20 meetings. So as we look to the end game, we are quickly moving in that direction. So you will note that if necessary, we will continue this evening at 6 p.m. in room 200. And we have a full agenda today. Representative Kreisha, I know you haven't even sat down yet, but if you would quickly look at the minutes.
I move the minutes, Madam Chair.
Representative Kreisha moves approval of the minutes from February 19th. Are there any corrections or additions?
I'll defer to Representative Wills.
Members, you'll note that we are now including the title of the bill after we have it introduced by the chief author or whomever has moved the bill. Hearing no concerns, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Representative Murphy, welcome to our committee. Continuation of House File 46, which I will take off the table. Members, we want to finish this bill by 8:45, so it is important that we get our questions asked. First, we have, though, a couple of testifiers who have concerns. So welcome to the committee, Representative Murphy. Please introduce yourself and identify your reason for being here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Representative Erin Murphy, and I'm here because we're hearing the universal pre-K bill and because, you know, I love education and I love being before your committee. There was one testifier from Children's Defense Fund who was unable to testify last week when we heard the bill, and she's here now. And if you'd be so kind, I would love it if she would make a presentation.
Please come forward. Please identify yourself for the record and begin.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jessica Anderson. I'm the Legislative Affairs Director for Children's Defense Fund Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today on universal pre-K, and thank you to Representative Murphy for bringing this bill forward. The Children's Defense Fund Leave No Child Behind mission is to ensure every child a healthy start, a head start, a fair start, a safe start, and a moral start in life. Nationally, our organization has been a strong champion for universal preschool. We believe it is a path to improving early learning opportunities for all children and ensuring that every child is ready for kindergarten. Universal pre-K is effective at reaching all eligible children and is shown to have educational benefits to children from families at all income levels. We know how important early learning opportunities are to children from low-income families when it comes to leveling the playing field and improving outcomes. Children from moderate-income families are shown to lag behind their wealthier peers as well, both socially and cognitively. And in the absence of a universal pre-K program, many moderate-income families are priced out of preschool programs, but their incomes are too high to qualify for public assistance. Universal pre-K could help address this challenge. Like CDF, this committee knows how important early childhood experiences are to child outcomes. That's why we support universal pre-K as a pathway to accessing early learning opportunities. That's also why we support programs like Head Start, Early Learning Scholarships, and the Child Care Assistance Program. We believe these programs are all valuable and can complement each other in order to best serve children and meet the needs of families. And just before I conclude, as an example of how CCAP might work with universal pre-K, as you know, CCAP serves children 0 to 12. About 12% of children on CCAP are 4 years old. So those children might end up using the universal pre-K program, but because their parents might still work early mornings, late nights, weekends, they might still need the child care assistance program to help meet their family's child care needs. Thank you for allowing me to testify today, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much. And we'll proceed to those with concerns, unless there was someone else in the audience who wanted to speak in support of House File 46. Then let's move to those with concerns, and I have a Susan Johnson listed. Please come forward and introduce yourself.
Hi,
Hi, Madam Chair and committee members. Thank you for hearing my testimony. I'm Susan Johnson. I have been a child care provider in St. Louis Park and Edina for 26 years. I love my job. I love my children. Studies have shown that children learn best in play-based situations, which is what I provide. As I say to my prospective clients, I work to provide an environment conducive to learning rather than pushing academics. My children learn at their own pace in a safe, loving, consistent home. I think it's important for families to have control over the type of care their children receive. There's no universal solution. Each has a different learning style, and parents take that into account when choosing care. For instance, I have families who are distanced from their extended families. They feel it's important to have their children in multi-age programs with a consistent caregiver. Younger children learn as I'm going over the concepts with the older kids, and the older children learn compassion and patience and also cement their learning that they had earlier while they play with the younger ones. Other families may have access to aunts, uncles, cousins, and grandparents, and the choices they make for child care will be different. It should be their choice. I agree that all children should have access to quality care, but you need to be good stewards of the taxpayers' resources. Target the at-risk children, not all children. Investigate the teaching methods that foster curiosity and love of learning rather than having them enrolled in school settings. If we take this choice away from families, I know that family child care programs will have an even harder time existing, and providers that do stay will have to raise rates in order to stay open. This will hurt families, and the added taxes needed to pay for the universal pre-K will further hurt those families. Please consider the long-term ramifications of this bill for Minnesota families, and do not pass the bill out of this committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson, and you will stay around in case there are questions.
Sure.
Thank you. And Ms. Seville, and if there's anyone else here who is having concerns about House File 46, please come forward at this time. Welcome to our committee. Please
Thank
say
you,
your
Madam
name for
Chair.
The record and begin.
Thank you, committee members, for allowing me to speak. My name is Holly Seville, and I'm a licensed family child care provider in St. Michael. I've been a licensed provider for more than 9 years. I've also worked in centers, public preschools, and many classrooms with ages kindergarten all the way up to 12th grade. So I have extensive experience in all settings. I've also earned a master's degree in early childhood education. I am here as a mom to a third grader and a kindergartner, an early childhood professional, and a taxpayer to urge you to please vote against House File 46. Education, especially early childhood education, should not be viewed as one-size-fits-all nor universal. We are robbing children of their childhood for the push for them to be ready to declare their major by the time they get to kindergarten. The standards are not developmentally appropriate, so it's not surprising that children aren't ready. Ironically, the Minnesota Department of Education 2006 Readiness Study Report stated that its goal is, quote, not to establish whether or not children are ready for school. Young children develop rapidly and at varying rates across the domains, and an early definitive determination of readiness can have unintended negative consequences. That's straight from the Minnesota Department of Education. What a shift they've made. Research does not show the long-term benefits of formal preschool. In fact, there is mounting evidence that the overly academic nature of formal preschool programs is detrimental to children's development. You should have a reference list in your packets. Researchers at Stanford University found that kindergartners who had 15 hours or more of preschool every week were less motivated and more aggressive in class. Oklahoma, a state that's continually touted for its universal preschool program, started it in 1988 and has the highest quality rating scores according to the National Institute for Early Education Research. In 1992, their NAEP fourth grade reading scores were above the national average, but have been below the national average every time the test was taken since then. In 2010, the same test showed that 72% of Oklahoma fourth graders are below grade level reading proficiency. Georgia's results are similar. Some of the best education systems in the world, such as Finland and South Korea, do not start formal education until the ages of 6 or 7. Their students consistently rank highest in science, math, and reading. the United States ranks an abysmal 17th. Let's fix K-12 education before trying to implement unfounded changes to early childhood education. This bill subsidizes people who can already afford to pay for preschool. Statistics also show that as many as 70% of four-year-olds are already enrolled in some form of preschool program. Universal preschool would pull children from their existing programs and harm private programs in the process. Private child care providers and preschools will have difficulty competing with the allure of free preschool while dealing with regulations and expenses that public preschool programs do not face. Providers would be forced to raise their rates. It's disheartening that this bill implies that children are only ready for kindergarten if they attend a public preschool program. However, home experiences and programs like mine that foster love for learning through active exploration, play, and sensory experiences ensure that children are naturally prepared for life and school success. Universal preschool does not and cannot address the importance of love for children throughout their childhood, including in education. So I invite you to beg you to please vote no on House File 46, and I'm happy to take any further questions on research.
Thank you, Ms. Savel. And please introduce yourself and begin.
Hi, my name is Ayan Bore. Thank you for you listening to me, all of you.
I really welcome to our committee.
Thank you. I don't think I can speak like her, but I'll try myself. My name is Ayan Bore. I'm a single mom. I raise my kids, and I have some little ones still. I'm just asking you to give a choice for mothers like me. Mothers like me is a single mom, and if I send my child for, let's say, this school, and transfer place to, in the morning, I work like 6 in the morning, and 6, if I pick up my child, like, please change it. It's going to be very difficult, and it's really hard for me to focus in my work during the 4 years old in school. And I would like to have a choice myself to put my child where I want. And I choose Mansouri. That's where I feel comfortable, and that's where I feel as a mother, single mother, with low income. If you take away for that opportunity, for me, it will be really difficult for every mother. And some of my community, I'm from Somalia, but I'm American. They prefer to go their own ethnicity, like people they can understand. People they have a lot of child care center who's really doing well. And I'm really appreciate it if you really consider for a 4 years old to put school instead of mother or father. I mean, parent can have a choice, and they take what they feel their kids to be comfortable. I'm not against for the school, but I'm just against for ideal saying one place to put the child. I want to have a chance, and I want to please consider for a kids, for like mother like me or parent like me. Please, I'm asking you to.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. We have one last one. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Sandy Persley, Interim Executive Director for MLFCCA, Minnesota Licensed Family Child Care Association. The mission of MLFCCA is to support licensed family child care providers to achieve the highest standards of care for children in Minnesota's diverse licensed family child care homes and communities through education, resources, services, and advocacy. MLFCCA opposes House File 46, Universal Preschool for 4-year-olds. The constituency MLFCCA represents has faced many challenges over the last several years. 4 years ago, there were nearly 12,000 licensed family providers in Minnesota. Now there are fewer than 9,700. This is a decrease of nearly 20% and has created a shortage of child care across the state, particularly in rural areas and especially for infant care. The negative impact of universal preschool will cause further economic harm to the profession of licensed family child care, limit choice for Minnesota families, increased cost for infant and toddler care and perhaps miss the goal of ensuring a quality education for preschool children. Universal preschool is a movement in direct conflict with research, as Holly identified, which amplifies the critical importance of early childhood play-based learning environments. Family child care is an optimal environment, supporting a child's interests, curiosities, allowing time to explore and experience learning at their individual pace and level of development, while providing consistent and dependable nurturing that fosters emotional development. For four-year-olds, social and emotional development is a vital forerunner to achieving educational milestones and being kindergarten ready. Universal preschool does not provide the answer to the question of which early learning environment provides the best preparation for kindergarten. The answer is provided by families having access to a range of choices and knowing what environment their child needs and will develop or learn best in. Family child care is a popular choice given a Minnesota marketplace where family providers serve thousands more preschool children than center or school-based care. Many family providers use state-approved curriculum and assessments and so provide high-quality early learning at an affordable cost for families. Universal preschool will significantly impact the sustainability of licensed family child care profession, which has lost significant numbers, as mentioned. Based on family child care adult-to-child ratios, universal preschool will force a market change that will create a financial burden for families seeking care for children birth to age three, because family child care programs will more than likely be forced to raise infant and toddler rates to earn a sustainable income. While the intent of universal preschool is to ensure every child has access to a quality education, most four-year-olds are already receiving some form of preschool education, no matter the setting. MLFCCA supports funding research that examines all the factors contributing to a child's school readiness in order to target funding precisely and appropriately to ensure school readiness. MLFCCA supports targeting early learning dollars so children in need are supported instead of allowing all families a free public school-based preschool education. Licensed family child care providers cannot compete with free care and education offered through local schools. Universal preschool will cause economic harm to the profession of licensed family child care, limit choice for Minnesota families, increased cost for infant and toddler care, and perhaps miss the goal of ensuring a quality education for all preschool children. We urge you to stand with licensed family child care providers and oppose this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Pursley. And members, you have at your places a series of handouts that were emailed to Ms. Mayo, our committee administrator. And I wanted to recognize Jody Withers, who is sitting in for Ms. Mayo this morning. She had some issues with her diabetes, and so she may arrive later if she is up to it. She is in her office trying to recover. So please bear with us. Welcome back to the table, Representative Murphy. And Representative Wills has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my question is actually for the author, Representative Murphy. I was just thinking back over the last couple of years, and I know the legislature passed legislation to allow the unionization of child care providers about 2 years ago. And I was just wondering how House File 46 would fit in with that effort and what AFSCME's position is on the bill.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Wells. I have spoken briefly with a representative from AFSCME who has said to me that they do not have concerns with the piece of legislation as it's drafted. And to your question about how this impacts or interplays with the unionization of child care workers, honestly, I think those are separate issues. I think child care workers now, because of the law that we passed, have the choice whether to organize or not. And that, you know, is happening, and there's a discussion happening out in Minnesota about that. This legislation, and I think it's important that I correct or make sure the committee understands that this legislation creates universal pre-K that is voluntary.
I do want to say in my 8 years in the legislature, I have been first amazed at the sense of camaraderie and agreement around the value of early education when I served on the Early Childhood Committee in my first term. And in the last couple of years, I have been amazed and somewhat disappointed at the very hard-edged and fragmented discussion among those working in this arena here at the Capitol and otherwise. So from my perspective, universal pre-K, which is voluntary, is an important addition to what we're already doing in the early learning arena. And it is additive and not a choice between one or the other. And the notion that school-based pre-K would somehow eliminate structured or would somehow eliminate play as a means of learning, that somehow children would be devoid or divorced from a love of learning or a separation from one another as people, as young learners, or from families is, I think, a strong statement of someone's perspective, but not at all rooted in fact. And so, Representative Wills, I think there are others that can better answer your question about the interplay between this and the organizing that may or may not be happening in Minnesota regarding child care providers. But I do think that this is a very important piece of legislation for this legislature to consider, especially when we know the statistics about early learners in Minnesota and the opportunity gap.
Representative Wills.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, thank you, Representative Murphy, for explaining that. I guess I do see a connection between the two simply because the legislation that passed, those who supported it advocated that it was an effort to increase the quality of child care providers and make that an improved service, and that was the goal behind it, as I understood it. And looking at that and then hearing from several testifiers today saying that they have concerns that if there was a universal pre-K program that they would lose business and that, you know, some of them may have to shut their doors because many children are already in those programs. I guess I'm sensing that there's a competition between the two, and so that's why I was wondering if AFSCME had concerns because they were behind the effort of strengthening the child care providers. I don't know if that makes sense, but that was the connection that I saw.
Madam Chair and Representative
Wills, Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I think that if organizing child care workers means better quality child care, good. And I think if universal pre-K means better early child learning, good. Those are good things for Minnesota. We are struggling in this arena. We need to do more to improve it. And our children have to come first in this discussion. They have to come first before the interests of the workers, before the interests of the child care providers. Our children have to come first. And so I am, you know, with restrained but clear message to you, I think it is very important that as we're hearing and listening to the people with concerns and support for this legislation, that we remember that our job here today really is in pursuit of a better education for our young learners in Minnesota. It's too important for our future not to focus on that provision of this piece of legislation.
Representative Seltzer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Murphy, for bringing forward this legislation, and I have several questions. One is around 2.3 to 2.5 in your legislation. And I know that there, you know, that we had concerns expressed by various child care providers that came forward today. And I noticed that in this portion of the bill, it says that programs must develop collaborative relationships with school-based early learning and also references community-based child care programs. And my questions are, you know, what would you say would be the definition of collaborative partnerships? And is there a fiscal piece to this? And if so, how would that work? Would the school district be a flow-through for dollars? So those are my questions there. And then after that, I just have one more question.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Seltzer. We have requested a fiscal note for this legislation. We, of course, know there's a fiscal cost to this legislation. And so I don't have a direct answer about the fiscal impact. I do know these things. We know in communities across the state of Minnesota that there are a variety of programs that are working in different ways serving young learners and families. And in different places, they are implemented in different ways. ECFE in St. Paul is different than ECFE in Winona. ECFE is doing family visiting in some communities, helping families raise their children and help with parenting. That's different than what's happening in St. Paul. So when we wrote this, we wrote it with the intention that we should have that discussion of how these fit together. And in part because, as I have been talking about this piece of legislation for the last year and a half, I have really noticed a sense of either or in the conversation and not we should do both. And as I testified last week before the committee, I believe that this fits in with the things like ECFE and Head Start and CCAP and licensed child care and scholarships. They fit together. There are waiting lists for almost every one of these programs in Minnesota. There are waiting lists in Greater Minnesota for child care. There are waiting lists for Head Start that we know of. There are waiting lists for CCAP. There are waiting lists for preschool. Families are looking for solutions, and we shouldn't choose one over the other. We should figure out how these fit together, and this piece of the legislation, Representative Seltzer, is an expression of that and a way for us to begin and nuance that discussion going forward through the session with this legislation.
Thank you. Representative Seltzer.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm happy to see that not only for the reasons that you enumerated, but also being a former school board chair myself, I know that there would not be the facilities even available to begin to meet the needs. So those collaborative partnerships are necessary. And I just have one more question, Madam Chair. I notice on 1.20 that you state that programs must employ licensed early childhood education teachers by January 1st, 2017. I think there might be a teacher shortage in this area, so I'm wondering exactly how that would be addressed. And I also wanted to clarify, this refers to school-based programs only. Is that correct?
Because Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair and Representative Seltzer, as I drafted this legislation, I was thinking about licensed teachers in school-based programs. I also understand and have heard now from a few people, not too many, but a few people about that deadline. I think it's important that we have high-quality teachers in our programs, and that's why we put a date in here, but I am willing to work with the committee and the experts to find a way to make sure that we are able to address what you're describing is a shortage of educators. Without foregoing, I think, the importance of making sure that we have licensed teachers in preschool environments.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good to see you here, Representative Murphy. Thank you for your presentation. I have a question. You know, as a first grade teacher, I totally understand the importance of early childhood preparedness. And I believe that happens in nurturing homes. It happens in our quality daycares and preschools that we have all throughout Minnesota. I believe, you know, the important part, as I see it as a teacher, is targeting those at-risk students who aren't getting, you know, that nurturing at home that maybe they need in the environment that stimulates their educational appetite and so on, gives them the background they need. So my question is more financial. I've always talked about prioritizing our money. You know, we don't have an endless pot of money in Minnesota, and we need to target our finances where they're needed most. If we offer universal pre-K, to me, that takes away from our at-risk students because we only have so much money, and we want to get those at-risk students in an environment where they can be nurtured for, you know, their upcoming education. So can you maybe address how I see it as watering it down and that we're going to actually take away from our at-risk students. I would love to see more scholarships to provide for those waiting lists for at-risk kids. So can you comment on that a little, please?
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Bennett. I have two comments on that. First of all, I think it is hard for us as a legislature or the state of Minnesota and the Department of Education to identify kids at risk in every home in Minnesota. I know that we talk about low-income families. We also talk about ACE scores. But kids don't live on a sliding fee scale. We don't necessarily know where those at-risk kids are. And so to try and target it based on that means an invasion, I think, into people's homes in a way that we don't generally do our work here in Minnesota. So that is my first point about at-risk. My second point is if we are focusing on and wanting to lift up all children, what better way to do that than to have a classroom full of kids from different backgrounds kids who come from upper income families who, you know, are thriving in their families and thus in education, and kids coming from families that are struggling. What better way for those children to learn than to be in a classroom together, all together, representing different income levels, different classes, different races, and so they can learn from each other and grow together. I think the strongest way to help our at-risk kids is to make sure they're in an environment that represents the best of Minnesota, and I think that means a family child care center or a classroom, a pre-K classroom with kids from all means so they can learn together and grow together.
Madam Chair, Representative Panage.
I understand your point, but again, where is the money going to come from for, you know, universal pre-K is a gigantic bite, as we might say, out of our educational pot. And where is that going to come from without taking away from the others?
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Bennett. The hard part of being a legislator is having to make those hard choices and prioritizing where we're going to put our resources. We are really in a lucky period of time right here, and you're a part of this now. We have a balanced budget. We balanced it 2 years ago. It's sturdily balanced. We have a growing economy, not in every part of the state. You know, I was in Albert Lea on Friday, and you know, Albert Lea has still got some struggles as I see it. But the economy is growing all over the state of Minnesota. We have a surplus. We're going to find out what that surplus looks on Friday. And this legislature is going to have to make a decision about where we're going to prioritize those funds. I think this is the right time for us to think about universal pre-K. I think it is the right time for us to think about making that smart investment, and it should come before some of the other things that this legislature is considering, such as corporate tax cuts.
Representative Winkler, last question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Murphy, I have one question about the bill. It's on 1.10, and it's about universal all-day preschool. And I wonder if some of the concerns about child care can't be addressed by eliminating that word all day, that hyphenated word all day. Because I know, for example, or I understand, I haven't been a four-year-old in Wisconsin, but my understanding is that in Wisconsin they have a universal pre-K program, but kids are basically both in daycare and they're in pre-K. And so the systems work pretty well together. The families have a child care option in the community that they prefer, if that's what they prefer. The kids get access to pre-K, and there isn't, I don't think, this need to fight over resources in that context. So the question is, first, if you think that that's an area where it might be fruitful to have some discussions with child care providers.
Representative Murphy.
Representative Erickson and Representative Winkler, yes. I think that is accurate. It's a place where we could have some discussion. We introduced this bill as a, you know, a strong proposal embracing universal pre-K for our children in the future. But I knew when I introduced it that there would be places where we were going to have discussions, especially around the interaction between pre-K and other providers, and I think it's time to have that discussion. Soon we'll have a fiscal note. We'll better understand the fiscal impact of this, and we can have then that discussion along with what is best for kids going forward.
Madam Chair, I just have a couple of comments. Along the same line, Representative Murphy, in your Subdivision 3 describing quality preschool programs, I don't think I saw transportation or specifically family education included in these criteria, and it occurs to me those would also be two things that would help to make this preschool program, using the parent aware model, a kind of a five-star program by the amount of wraparound services that it provides. So those would be a couple of additional points, it seems to me, that would be relevant, and especially transportation in the context of partnering with child care providers.
Representative Murphy. Oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Representative, Madam Chair and Representative Winkler, I believe, because this bill is envisioning a school-based program that transportation is already accounted for. But I would be happy to work with you to make sure that we're thinking that through and making sure that it works going forward.
And, you know, Madam Chair,
Representative Winkler.
Members, I was co-author now on the scholarships bill and was a strong advocate for scholarships. And we do have this debate, apparently, going on between creating a targeted program versus creating a universal program. The advantages of a targeted program is that you can focus resources where they're needed the most. You get the highest return on investment, and through the scholarship linked to Parent Aware, you can create a market. You can change the quality of the child care market. You can use the state resources to leverage up the quality of that entire market. I think that's good. I think the downside or the challenge is that we, as a legislature, have a poor record of actually prioritizing needy kids. They're not the best lobbyists. They're not very well organized. It may be the frequent bathroom breaks or whatever. I don't know. But the kids are not very good at showing their political power at the Capitol, and as a result, we tend not to do very well by them. And it's a little bit like in higher education. We say, well, we don't need to worry about the cost of tuition because we're going to have a lot of financial aid for needy students. And it just turns out that the financial aid just never quite keeps up with the amount of tuition that we're charging. And so that's kind of a, I think, a concern or a downside of a targeted model. And on top of that, we've got a lot of middle-class families who struggle to pay for high-quality early learning and costs. And by targeting resources, we may be helping the kids most at need, but we also don't do a lot for families who still have high costs. On the other hand, a universal program like this, the pre-K program, it serves all kids. The program is aligned for kids to be successful in school, and we have all of the kind of what I would call five-star services available for these programs to help kids in all of their needs, which the private child care market doesn't do a lot of. As excellent as many of the programs and providers are. And the downside of a universal program is that we end up spending a lot of money for services for kids who don't really need them, and it's expensive. So, I mean, it's pretty easy to get into a fight between these two models. But I really think the difference, the big fight here is about prioritizing kids at all. We have a big budget. We spend a lot of money in education. We spend a lot of money in a lot of areas. But we spend very, very little on getting young kids the success, the chance at success that they need. And the research is devastating in many ways, that if you don't get the first chapter of their lives right, the rest of the book is already almost pre-written. And that's just not something we can afford to wait on. So, Representative Murphy, I support your bill. I think that the answer to targeted versus universal should be yes. We need to do both, and we need to get off the dime and keep this moving, building on scholarships. I don't see any reason why getting to serve all the kids who need services in the state is going to include schools doing a lot of it. It's going to include child care providers. It's going to take targeted resources. It's going to take a universal program, all hands on deck, all rowing in the same direction in order to get this thing done. And so I think we should move the bill along today. And so, Madam Chair, I think your motion was to lay it over, and I'd like to make a motion that we recommend this bill to pass and move it to the Education Finance Committee.
Representative Winkler has moved this bill to be referred to the Committee on Finance.
And I think we should have a roll call, Madam Chair.
And we can have a roll call on that. Representative Dabney.
Madam Chair, I want to thank Representative Winkler for the motion. I was perplexed last week when you made the motion for a finance bill to be laid over for the policy committee. I think, obviously, as Representative Murphy indicated, we're waiting on a fiscal note. This year we've sent bills out of the finance committee without waiting for a fiscal note, but we certainly shouldn't delay a clearly fiscal bill in the policy committee while we wait for the fiscal note. It belongs in the possession of Chair Loon's committee, and I hope that members on both sides of the aisle will support that and move it to where it belongs.
Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick comment to a point Representative Winkler made, and that is he stated that we don't do a very good job here at the legislature. And the point I'd like to make is perhaps that's because we're too far removed, right? And we mistakenly think that we can do a better job than the local school districts. And in their very name, it says independent school district. And what we should do is continue to return local control to them and empower them to achieve what they are supposed to, what they're charged to do, not mistakenly think that we can do better than they can on a local level. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And members, keep in mind that in the Finance Committee, we do have the governor's proposal. So with that said, the clerk will take the roll.
Madam Chair?
No.
Vice Chair Bennett?
No.
Mariani?
Yes.
Bly?
Yes.
Christensen?
No.
Dabney?
Yes.
Kreisha?
No.
Lucero?
No.
Moran?
Yes.
Nornes?
No.
Peterson?
No.
Pearson?
No.
Seltzer?
Yes.
Erdahl?
No.
Ward?
Yes.
Whalen?
No.
Wills?
No.
Winkler?
Yes.
Yaruso?
Yes.
Apparently we know better.
There being 7 ayes and 11 nays, the motion does not prevail. Representative Murphy, closing comments.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And I just have to say, I'm surprised that the committee has voted not to send this on to the Finance Division for hearing. I don't know what that says about this legislature's intention to deal with early learning, but from my perspective, we can't wait anymore. We are hearing from parents about their struggle to afford pre-K that they want it for their children. We know that we have an achievement gap that's yawning. We know that there are people on waiting lists waiting for quality care, quality child care, and we know that education is a powerful tool in Minnesota. It's something that Minnesotans support, and so I am, I guess, a little stunned that the committee's just voted down a universal pre-K bill, and I'm not sure what that says or what Minnesotans should take from that. But I think Minnesotans have, I think they're frustrated with the delay that we have shown in investing in early learning. And we just took a step backward. So, I'm grateful that you heard the bill. I will tell you that I'm a little stunned by the committee's vote.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. And members, remember, this compliment is in the governor's proposal. So I'm sure there will be more discussions in finance. With that, the chair lays this bill on the table. And members will move to Representative Pintos, 424. Welcome to our committee, Representative Pinto. Representative Mariani. Oh, thank you. Representative Mariani will move House File 424 once the author has introduced himself.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Representative Dave Pinto from District 64B. I think I've met most of you and those that I haven't. I look forward to doing so very soon. In keeping with tradition, I've brought in some treats. This is my first bill hearing. Those treats do include apples, since this is the Education Committee. Unfortunately, they are from Washington State. I'll just full disclosure, you can't get fresh apples in Minnesota at this time of year, but in any case, enjoy. And so I think the pages are distributing.
And Representative Pinto, you have an amendment, I believe. Representative Mariani, would you move Representative Pinto's amendment, the H0424A1? Representative Mariani moves the A1 amendment. Will you please explain your amendment, Representative Pinto?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will. The underlying bill is a technical fix to the data practice law governing directory data, which is a kind of educational data to make it conform to federal law. What the author's amendment does is it removes having that be an ongoing connection with federal law. We thought the committee would be more comfortable with setting a particular date. We can explain when we get the underlying bill why this particular date, rather than it being an ongoing thing, and also adds a phrase that that simply makes that technical fix actually conform to federal law in the way that we want.
Thank you, Representative Pinto, and thanks for making those technical changes. All those in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Please give any further explanation of 424 as needed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, this bill came from our local school district approaching me regarding a really exciting initiative that they want to do, working with local libraries to connect students with provide them with a library card and have a seamless connection there. There's a particular category of data in the data practice law called directory data. This is defined under federal law, and this information is so that a school can provide a student's name or other information to reveal the fact that a student is in fact a student of the school for purposes of, let's say, a play program or a graduation ceremony, that kind of thing. Right now in our law, directory data is defined consistent with federal law, and in 2012 there was a change that was made in federal law to give some more flexibility to that. I'm going to have Nancy Cameron, who's the general counsel for the St. Paul School District, describe this further, but simply want to point out that there is information on the committee website regarding support for the bill from the Minnesota Association of School Administrators, Minnesota School Board Administrators Association, and public law section of the Minnesota State Bar Association supportive as well in other districts. So I'll turn things over with the chair's permission to Ms. Cameron, the general counsel for the St. Paul Schools.
Thank you very much, Representative Pinto. Welcome to our committee, Ms. Cameron, and please say your name for the record and begin.
Thank you. I'm Nancy Cameron. I'm the general counsel for St. Paul Public Schools. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. As by way of background, the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, which is also commonly known as FERPA, a federal law, requires that school district obtain a parent's written consent prior to disclosure of personally identifiable information from students' records. However, school districts may disclose personally identifiable information that has been designated as directory information. And what House File 424 goes to today is the directory information provision. And when school districts disclose directory information, they can do so without written consent unless the parent has opted out of the disclosure. And I will talk briefly about that in a moment. The primary purpose of directory information is to allow the school districts to include information about a student in certain school publications. And Representative Pinto gave a couple examples, a school play, graduation programs, could be the annual yearbook, honor rolls, a list of athletes. Those are just some of the examples. Under FERPA, the directory information is information that is generally not considered harmful or an invasion of privacy to disclose. It may include the student's name, address, telephone, photograph, grade level, awards and degrees, and honors. FERPA allows the school district to disclose the information without written consent if the school district has given parents proper notice, and the notice must include the types of personally identifiable information that has been designated as directory, the parent's right to opt out of the directory information disclosure, and the time period within which a parent has to notify the district that it has opted out. What's new in the 2012 federal law is that school districts may specify in its notice that the disclosure of directory information may be limited to specific parties for specific purposes or both. The district must then limit the disclosure of the directory information to the parties or purposes specified in the notice. So St. Paul Public Schools, like many school districts, does not treat student addresses as directory information. It keeps the addresses private. Using the federal law, St. Paul would like to make addresses available to some parties, but not to all. And as Representative Pinto mentioned, we are talking about the library, most specifically in our case. We are working towards a limitless library modeled after the program in Nashville. And under this program, the school district will be able to get library cards to public school students on a school-by-school basis by sharing the addresses with the St. Paul Public Library, which, by the way, the St. Paul Public Library considers patron addresses to be private data as well. Making the Minnesota law consistent with the federal law will allow us to share the directory information, for example, addresses with parties we designate, for example, the library, but it won't force us to disclose that information to unnamed parties like the media. This bill has the support of the public law section of the Minnesota State Bar Association, the general counsels of the metro area school districts, and I'm also asking for your support. Thank you.
And members, this bill will be moving to civil law. So are there questions from members?
Nice job, Representative Pinto. Oh, Representative Wills.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just curious, do other states conform to the federal definition, or is this unique for Minnesota? I'm just wondering.
Ms. Cameron.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the other states, the federal law gives school districts the ability to determine what they designate as directory information. So each state has that option. Each school district has that option, but then individual states may have imposed additional requirements. So in Minnesota, by virtue of the inclusion of the directory information provision in 1332, in 1332, the law says the directory information is public, and it says it as of the certain date. But what we're saying is, since the federal law says we could restrict who it's public to certain parties or certain for certain purposes, then if we can conform our state law to the federal law, we will be able to limit who gets it. And I can't speak to what other states do in terms of their application of it. But it is a federal law, and they all school districts could determine how to designate directory information.
And Ms. Cameron, when this bill is heard in civil law, you might want to have an answer to that question, because if you testify with Representative Pinto, you may get asked it. You know, what do other states do, so that we can compare? With that, members, I will renew Representative Mariani's motion that House File 424, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails, and the bill will be heard in civil law. Thank you very much.
Thank you
for
Chair.
The treats, especially the apples, Representative Pinto.
No, especially the donuts.
And thank you, Mr. Pinto. Thank you, Ms. Cameron, for coming.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
That'll move us to Representative Anderson, 672. Welcome back to our committee, Representative Anderson. And members, I will move House File 672 to be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Welcome again to our committee, Representative Anderson. Please introduce your bill for us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Out of respect for your time, I will be very brief. What my bill does is it allows for computer science to count towards the math credit in our academic standards that we have. I do have a testifier with me today, and with that, I'll leave it to you, Ms. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. And please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
My name is Jim Russell. I'm a constituent of Plymouth, Minnesota, where Sarah Anderson is a representative. Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you very much for allowing this opportunity. Minnesota is one of 25 states that does not allow math or science credit for computer science. Nationwide, fewer than 1% of all advanced placement enrollment is computer science. Now, if you focus just on STEM-related AP courses, computer science represents only 2% of the total enrolled, despite 60% of STEM jobs being computer science-related. These jobs that are computer science-related pay 75% more than the national median salary. Today, there are fewer computer science majors in college than there were 10 years ago. So why is that? These are some really conflicting statistics. It pays more, there's fewer people going into it. The answer is marginalized incentivization. The promise of a high-paying job just isn't enough for a high school student to enroll in computer science. Their short-term goal is to graduate. A simple elective credit for a difficult class is not enough incentive for a student to risk a low grade that may reduce their GPA in the face of tightening college entrance requirements. So the computer science education engine isn't broken. It's just behaving exactly how it was designed. My high school experience was a bit different. I asked for and received early computer science training through the math department at Pequot Lakes High School. Some 20 years later now, I have the opportunity to meet with engineering management and executives across the country and across many different vertical markets. One of their most common stated challenges is the difficulty of hiring qualified software engineers. We ought not force our children to actively reach out for computer science education. It should not only simply be offered, made available to them, proper credit should be given for these classes, for these kids, for their effort to learn this important skill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Russell. Are there questions from members? Representative Whalen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Anderson, for bringing this bill. Just a clarifying question for if we allow this to be a math credit, does that include, so could this replace Algebra 2, replace Geometry, replace Statistics and Probability, one, all, how would that fit in?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Whalen. No, it doesn't replace those. If you actually look in subdivision one mm-hmm. of the statute language, that's already put in place that Algebra 2 has to be part of the standard. This would be just an addendum to them to this math credit so that if a student wanted to use this as part of it, they could, but it doesn't replace those core classes.
Representative Whalen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry, maybe I didn't phrase the question correctly. So I think that right now they need three math classes, and would this would just be one option in the pool. So say I could take geometry, I could take statistics, and I could take a science STEM class. Is my understanding correct?
Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative Whalen. Yes, that's
okay.
Correct.
Thank you. Just a brief comment. A constituent recently emailed me about this very issue, and they'll be very happy with your bill. So thank you. I'm in full support.
Representative Mariani.
Thank you, and I appreciate Representative Whalen's questions. Representative Anderson, I think this is a good idea. So who determines whether a computer science course offered would meet the state academic standards in mathematics? Who makes that determination?
Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair and Representative Mariani, it would be a combination, I assume, of both the school district itself and then also the state, but Ms. Larson might have further details on that.
Ms. Larson.
Madam Chair, members, Representative Anderson is correct. The state establishes the standards and underlying benchmarks, but it would be incumbent upon the districts to determine whether the particular courses the district is offering is consistent with the law.
Representative Mariani.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, do we know whether the Department of Education considers this a good idea?
Representative Anderson, have you spoken with MDE?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Mariani. In my research, what I looked at is what we've seen in activity of other states. I haven't had a direct communication with the Department of Ed. I've had communication, though, with other outside groups. This legislation has received support from, I think you'll hear from the Minnesota High Tech Association and other entities that are in this realm, because there is a severe shortage of people entering this field, which puts the United States and Minnesota in particular at a disadvantage. If you look out into the future, we will have 1 million more jobs in this sector than we have students for, if you look at the 2020 perspective, and which is really unfortunate because, as Mr. Russell highlighted, these are good, high-paying jobs. The other issue, too, that I'm hoping to address on this is to make sure that we are expanding opportunities for women and students of color in particular. This is part of a movement by Code.org, which has been encouraging students to get actively engaged, because it is a huge growth opportunity from a financial perspective for the students and also for us in the technology that they'll be able to develop. But no, I have not heard directly from the department on this issue.
Madam Chair.
Representative Mariani, I think we have someone coming now.
Madam Chair, that was going to be my suggestion. And while they do, Madam Chair, I think Representative Anderson laid out the reasons for moving in this direction. And I concur, but I'm curious to know where the department's...
Welcome to the committee. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Steve Huser, Deputy Director of Government Relations at the department. We do have, I wouldn't necessarily say a concern, but just want to make sure that any of these courses actually do meet the standards, and I know that the bill does specify that. We do have some concern how that would work as a practical matter, but we're more than willing to work with the author.
Thank you very much. Representative Mariani.
Madam Chair, earlier we heard from Representative Lucero reference to independent school districts and how we just simply need to get out of the way of independent school districts to make decisions. This is a really good example of why that, as a principle, is a bad principle. We absolutely respect independent school districts. In fact, they exist because the legislature says they should exist. The Constitution is very clear about our responsibility to education. It's a state responsibility. We have chosen as a people to use independent school districts by which to deliver that. But the responsibility lies to the state. And this is a perfect little example of why, relative to making sure that we have high-quality standards that apply to all students, and not just to some students by virtue of accident of what school district they happen to be in. I know we've debated this issue before. Madam Chair, I think this is quite workable between the department and the proponents here, and I look forward to us advancing this proposition.
Representative Daphne.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I appreciate Representative Anderson bringing the bill forward. I've historically been a bit of a skeptic about allowing, I remain skeptical allowing business teachers to teach economics, because I assume they're not actually teaching economics, they're teaching business. Those are different things. But I was okay with the science, with the ag teachers taking over some science. I'm good on this. But Representative Anderson, you did put an equity frame over this, and I am particularly excited about that. Mr. Russell referenced low percentage of students taking AP classes, but with an equity frame, AP is a weak option. Representative Anderson, what can you tell us about access through dual enrollment or PSEO to computer science classes for students? Those tend to be, particularly dual enrollment, much stronger options from an equity framework than AP.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Daphne. You raised a good issue. I'd like to do some research further on that in particular. When I looked at this legislation, what I examined was the current standards that we have in place for math and how the computer science would comply with that. Mm-hmm. And there are several areas within the math standards that we have that marry well with the computer science component and should do well. There are other opportunities, as you said, the post-secondary option, but I hadn't looked at that component, but I'm happy to do so. And if you have some suggestions or comments on that in particular, I'd happy to hear them.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Representative Anderson, you had another testifier, is that correct?
I do.
So the representative from Minnesota High Tech, please come forward. Welcome to our committee, sir, and please say your name for the record and begin.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, John Dukic with the Minnesota High Tech Association. We represent more than 300 science and technology companies and organizations from across the state with the goal of helping Minnesota become a top 5 technology state. And a key piece of what we work on at the High Tech Association is STEM education and workforce development. Depending on the statistics that you reference and the sources that you reference, we'll need anywhere between 80,000 and 180,000 STEM jobs by 2020. Many of these jobs include titles such as computer science or computer systems analyst, mm-hmm. software developer, or computer support specialist, and these often require a degree in computer science. So we feel that allowing computer science courses to fulfill a math graduation requirement will expose more students at an earlier age to computer science courses and give them the skills they need to enter the workforce. And with that, we thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Anderson, closing comments.
Just encourage members, if you haven't had a chance to go onto the website for code.org, if you have children yourself that would be interested in that, encourage you to do it. It's actually a very fun website, and it exposes you to all the possibilities that are out there. We all carry around these little phones, these smartphones, and that's all possible because of computer science and the brilliant minds that we have. And hopefully we can keep them here in the state of Minnesota by doing a policy like this.
And members, you do have in your folders a handout from code.org. I would hope that you would read through that and and get going on the website yourself, as I have done so. With that, the chair renews her motion that House File 672 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Thank you very much, Representative Anderson. Representative Fenton and House File 643. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Welcome to our committee, Representative Fenton, and I will move House File 643, we will hear it and hear your amendment shortly, and then it is my intention to advance it to the Committee on Education Finance. Please introduce yourself for us, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Representative Kelly Fenton, and I am excited to be here for moving this bill forward for the Minnesota Principals Academy. Because while the classroom teacher is the most visible person in a child's life at school, it is the principal who is responsible for providing a high-quality education for every student in their building.
And Representative Fenton, I'm going to move your amendment because I think you're explaining the bill to us. Members, I will move the H-0643-A3 amendment. Can you explain the amendment before you continue, please?
So what this amendment does is includes Minnesota State University Mankato into the bill. It's also some technical cleanup language, as well as there's a paragraph for appropriation if we're not able to fully fund the program. So that's what this amendment does.
Is there any discussion, Representative Dabney?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Fenton, looking at the language on 1.17 through 1.21 on the appropriation that you just referenced, can you tell me, there's apparently two programs in Minnesota, who has studied them, when were they studied, and what do we know about the results of the study of those two programs?
Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Dabney. There are two programs. One is is with the University of Minnesota. They use the national component in ISL, but they've also tailored it to include some specific Minnesota programs geared towards some of our evolving changes with education. And the other program is the Mankato State University. And you're going to hear from both of these programs today, but they're a newer program, so you're going to hear about how they've evolved and some of the research they've done as they've just it's new up and running, and I think they have the first group through it, but you're going to hear from them as well.
Madam Chair.
Representative Dabney.
But let me restate the question because maybe I lost it in my comments. Who has studied these programs? When were they studied, and what were the outcomes of those studies of the two Minnesota programs?
Okay.
I'm trying. You're putting a bias in for one of the programs, and I'm trying to understand who studied the programs. How do we know that program A is better than program B? So who studied them? When were they studied, and what were the outcomes of those studies?
Okay, and I'm going to
thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Dabney. And I'm going to turn this over to my testifier, Katie Peckle, who can tell you about the studies to the University of Minnesota program.
Welcome to our committee. Please say your name for the record.
Madam Chair, Katie Peckle from the
And this is just to Representative Dabney's question, please.
Correct.
Because we need to move this amendment so
yes.
We can hear the entire bill. Please
Absolutely.
Proceed.
Madam Chair, to Representative Dabney's question, I can only speak to the University of Minnesota's program, and I'm sure that representatives from Mankato State can speak to their program. The National Institute of School Leadership program was studied by Johns Hopkins University and Old Dominion from a time period of 2006 to 2010. Independent reports on their programs as they were operated in the states of Pennsylvania and Massachusetts were released in 2011. There is a research summary in your packet of those two. However, if you would prefer the full research reports, we're certainly happy to provide them to you. In both studies, it was found that schools led by NISL-trained principals had statistically significant higher rates of student achievement.
Representative Dabney.
But, Madam Chair, so no one has studied the U of M program and nobody has studied the Mankato program?
The U of M program was additionally studied through a program evaluation, not a controlled trial by the Center for Applied Research and Educational Improvement in 2010.
Thank you, Ms. Pickell. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none and hearing none,
Madam Chair,
Representative Dabney?
So, there's mouths open and hands flailing. And
okay.
I'm going to allow our representative from Mankato State to talk about their program.
Just to answer that question, yes.
Just to answer that question. Thank you very much. I'm Candace Raskin from Minnesota State Mankato. Our institute started in 2011. We have been studying it from the very beginning. We've had our first cohort graduate. We work with about 151 principals. In your packet of materials is the research that we've just finished conducting. It's going to be published in the Association of School Administrators Scholarly Practice. It'll be in the July issue. And our findings are our findings were very significant around the area of building the capacity of our principals being able to lead in Minnesota schools. So it's very much Minnesota focused. We're currently in the phase two of that program. We're studying independently those schools that have graduates from our program and looking at their student achievement. So we're relatively new, but we are on the boots on the ground from the minute we started, and we're continually studying it so we can inform the field.
Thank you, Ms. Russell. So, Representative Dabney.
Representative Fenton, then, if I'm still trying to understand the language regarding the appropriation, because now I've got two studies. Before I had one study, but not about Minnesota. Now I've got one study not about Minnesota and one story about Minnesota study, excuse me, and now I'm trying to understand how we apply your language in that scenario. And that's the place where I remain confused.
Representative Fenton.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Dabney. Essentially, this will be left up to the Commissioner of Education to award the grants.
Representative Dabney.
Madam Chair, I wouldn't want to be the Commissioner of Education.
Thank you.
Thank you.
No, you have Psi Math, so I think that's just fine.
Yeah, I'm happy.
I think you should stay there and serve us. Thank you very much. Is there any further discussion of Amendment A3? Hearing none and seeing none, all those in favor say aye. 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 Those opposed, no. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Now you can explain your bill, Representative Fenton. And testifiers, just stay close by because we'll hear from you again.
So as I stated before, principals play a critical role in the success of great schools. And they are responsible for school success. They lead teaching and learning. They hire, develop, and support excellent teachers. And they build strong school community. So simply put, the principal's job is a mixture of small details, big ideas, and long-range planning. Yet, very few receive ongoing professional development that enhances their ability to lead schools to high performance. So I'm excited to introduce this bill and ask for your support today. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to our first testifier to talk about some of the successes of the program.
Ms. Pickell, please say your name for the record again and begin.
Katie Pickell. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to briefly share with you today how we've approached the important and needed ongoing principal development within the Minnesota Principals Academy. I have with me today three people who you'd be more interested in hearing from in just a moment. Dr. F. Agbamu, past participant and current facilitator. Patty Johnson, a current participant and principal of the Hopkins High School. And her superintendent, Dr. John Schultz. Just as a way of introduction, I am a public school principal at heart and a short-term principal in residence at the University of Minnesota. I've served at both the elementary and middle school level, and I was a high school teacher. The Principal Leadership Institute, as you know, was established in 2005 to provide an opportunity for ongoing executive development for school leaders across Minnesota. At the time, the Minnesota Department of Education, MASSP, the Secondary School Principals Association, the Elementary School Principals Association, Minnesota Association of School Administrators, and the Minnesota Business Partnership were collaboratively to choose the National Institute of School Leadership's 13-unit executive development program to be the Curriculum Institute. Since that time, the Minnesota Principals Academy has operated at the University of Minnesota using that curriculum. Almost 2 years ago, the University of Minnesota, in collaboration with principals and superintendents associations, re-examined the curriculum, sought input from principals and superintendents around the state of Minnesota through a survey, and ultimately decided to continue with the initial curriculum, making four very specific enhancements to tailor to Minnesota. One, the specific inclusion of scholarly and practitioner resources addressing race, culture, and
and equity. Two, a direct connection of research to practice with University of Minnesota researchers sharing their research as it relates to elementary and secondary schools. Three, a unit specifically addressing Minnesota's teacher development and evaluation system was developed in collaboration with the Minnesota Department of Education and further supported by a unit on coaching as it relates to TDE. And finally, the participants engage in a rigorous action learning project where they identify a problem of practice in their setting based on school level data, supervisor input, and the program's instructional leadership and principles of learning, teaching, and curriculum self-assessment tool. They review relevant literature, identify a strategy, collect data, and then report on that. At this time, it would be important for you to have an opportunity to hear from folks that have directly interacted with the program. So Dr. F.A. Agbamu would be the first person to share that with us.
Thank you very much. Welcome to our committee. Please say your name for the record and begin.
F.A. Agbamu.
Welcome. Please present.
Thank you. Madam Chair, good day, everybody. I am here in support of the HF 643 Principal Leadership Academy. I've been fortunate to serve as a teacher in St. Paul Public Schools, principal in both St. Paul Public School and in a suburban setting. As a first-year principal, I struggled not knowing what to do with certain limitations, but was fortunate in 2006 to be part of the first Minnesota Principal Academy participant using the NISO curriculum. After that, things changed drastically for me. I began to look at things critically. I began to apply some of the strategies and the concepts we exploit. And after some time in St. Paul Public School, I went to the suburb. The good thing was that I took all of these experiences with me also to the suburb, and I'm proud to say that I was a very successful principal, even becoming Minnesota Principal of the Year, High School Principal of the Year in 2011, because of what I was exposed to. This training allowed me to challenge and address the following, in addition to others that I cannot mention because of time. It allowed me to address the academic gap. It created a sense of urgency for me to believe that every child is capable of achieving. It allowed me make informed decisions based on data. It allowed me create safety nets for students who are struggling. And it helped me move my high school out of corrective action under the old No Child Left Behind for 3 consecutive years. As a facilitator also in this program, I have also seen the light bulb go off in participants' faces. I've seen their aha's in the face of K-12 principals who are undergoing this training. I see them come face to face with the challenges of urban and suburban education, and I also see them leave with a desire to be actively involved in changing the lives of students through effective principal leadership. So in a nutshell, that is my experience with the Minnesota Principals Academy, and I am always looking forward to opportunity to facilitate and expose other participants to some of the things I have been fortunate to be exposed to.
Thank you very much, Ms. Babamu. Next, we have, is it perhaps John Schultz? Superintendent of Hopkins Public Schools.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm really here in support of this bill.
Please introduce yourself.
I'm John Schultz, Superintendent of Hopkins Public Schools, and I am here in support of this bill. Learning and education is a wonderfully complex thing, and it takes talented teachers. I applaud the legislature with the teacher development and evaluation that has come forward. We've embraced that. But I really believe that principals deserve support in delivering the teacher evaluation, but also just in the leadership and the direction and the vision of the school. And I am blessed as a superintendent to have Ms. Patty Johnson as the principal of Hopkins High School. One of the greatest things I get to do as superintendent is to watch a principal grow and watch the leadership blossom. And this program I have seen changes in Patty's leadership, Patty's vision, in addition to impacting learning. And the school itself, if you come to Hopkins High School, you will see Patty's vision. You'll sense who Patty is. And it all comes from the fact that she really establishes a culture of learning and a culture of collaboration. So I'm in full support of that bill, and Patty can tell you more about that when she's up here.
Ms. Johnson, please come to the table and introduce yourself. We're delighted to have a principal in our audience today. Please say your name for the record.
Yep. My name is Patty Johnson, and I'm principal at Hopkins High School. Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. I'm a present member of the Minnesota Principals Academy, and I'm here to share with you that it has been key in my development as a leader for Hopkins High School. I was a teacher for 10 years at the secondary level, and I've spent the last 10 years as an administrator in the last 7 at Hopkins High School. There are 3 areas in which the Minnesota Principals Academy has helped me in my growth and development. Number one, the best practice research and units of focus have been key. We focus on areas of standards-based instructional systems, school design, professional development, equity, foundations of effective learning, teacher development and evaluation, teacher coaching, and instructional leadership. Number two, the cohort model is second to none. I have the opportunity to interact with principals, assistant principals, directors, superintendents, both in urban and in rural school districts. And number three, I have the opportunity to interact with practitioner facilitators and many of the faculty from the University of Minnesota. As I said, it has been key to my professional development, and I'm in full support of continuing this work and to give the opportunity for future principals to participate in the Minnesota Principals Academy. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you for your leadership in your school and in our state. Ms. Pickell, your testifiers are finished. So then I'd like Ms. Raskin to please come back to the table and testify to the Mankato State University program. Welcome, and please say your name again for the record.
Candace Raskin. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Candace Raskin. I am a professor and the chair of the Department of Educational Leadership at Minnesota State Mankato, a former superintendent, elementary principal, middle school principal. And I come to you today first to thank the author for bringing the bill forward and amending it to include and restore Minnesota State's eligibility to support the Principal Academy. To start with, the state has an urgent need and a huge need that not just one institution or one university can fulfill. And I really appreciate your support of high-quality leadership development for all principals. This bill is an excellent first step. Just briefly, Minnesota State Mankato Principal Institute was launched in 2011, and we serve 151 principals from 14 districts across the state. The institute is a cohort model. It's a 2-year job-embedded program and shows promising impact on leadership capacity and student achievement. I've handed out a packet with some key information so that I don't take up a lot of your time. There's some key facts about our institute, and then I've also given you a snapshot of our curriculum and our approach, because we use an adaptive approach to our institute in really looking at what's happening in the fields and continually adapting our curriculum. I also included the study of our first graduates, and that will be published in the American Association for School Administrators Journal of Scholarship and Practice in July. And I hope you take time to review that, because the results are promising. They're very promising. And as I talked about earlier, we are currently right now looking at the schools, the student achievement, because ultimately that's where it matters. Can we change the achievement of what is occurring in schools with the way that we are developing sitting principals? And so we're looking at that now, and we'll have the results of that study this summer. In closing, we would like to work with the author as the bill moves forward and align its provisions and to ensure that they use the best practices in the field. And again, I want to thank the author for bringing the bill forward and amending it to include Minnesota State Mankato. And I want to thank Madam Chair, members of the committee, for allowing me this brief moment and sharing my information with you about what we're doing and the work we're doing around principal development at Minnesota State Mankato. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Why don't you stay for a moment, just in case?
Sure.
You're one of those who wants to be questioned. Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Fenton, excuse me. First of all, I appreciate you and I have been trying to connect on this bill, and you've been very generous about responding to me, but for whatever reason, we just haven't quite connected. So thank you for responding to my my outreach to you. Obviously, as for me, as the bill was introduced, it caused concern, a lot of concern, particularly because the draft, you know, proactively struck originally the Mankato State University program out. So your amendment is a good amendment. It allows us to continue to have that option before Minnesotans and the principals in Minnesota. And all full disclosure, Madam Chair, I've spoken at this program in the past in my capacity as executive director of a race equity student of color organization. And so I presented to the principals, so I know probably more about it than I do the University of Minnesota program. Although I was certainly around here when former Representative Alice Segrin championed that cause, and I joined her in doing so because I think it's proper for us to make this investment. However, let me just say, when I add up the dots in terms of, okay, so the bill originally struck out Mankato State University and then lays out a framework by which applicants would be identified, accepted, and then eventually evaluated. For me, it raises hopefully an objective question about, so is the rest of the bill then not really tailored around the University of Minnesota's program as opposed to the Mankato State University program? So I want to make sure that when we come out of here, and I hope we do this, I think we need to make this investment, that when we come out of here that we haven't tilted, you know, the evaluation and the ongoing investment frame toward one program versus another program. And so maybe very quickly, so that's really more a comment for you. If this bill moves forward, I want to continue to work with you. I've met with Ms. Pacal at the University of Minnesota. We've had similar conversation. I've met with Ms. Raskin. I'm just very quickly for Ms. Raskin, am I off here in terms of looking at the new sort of criteria here about getting students, or rather principals, in? Are there areas there that do not align with or that cause you to concern about whether they align with the Mankato State University program?
Ms. Raskin.
Thank you. Absolutely, and that was part of my closing comments, was that we would really like to work hand-in-hand with the author of the bill as we move forward to ensure that it incorporates the best practices that we're using in this institute, and there's enough work for all of us so that we're blending and assuring that we're doing the right kinds of programming for all of our principals in Minnesota. So there are some places in there that very much are tilted exactly to the U of M's program and would make it difficult for our program to be included for funding.
Madam Chair, that a closing comment for me, because I know we're time here. I hope that the representative and the two representatives of the institutions here can spend some time to really opening up this language and make sure that it works equitably for both programs, but more importantly, so that our principals have maximum choices before them as they engage in this important leadership development.
Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it is my intent to work with all involved, Mankato State and University of Minnesota, as the bill moves forward for best practices, because the most important thing, I think, is that we allow as many principals as possible across the entire state to have access to either program.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I just want to thank Representative Fenton for bringing this bill forward, and to say I definitely agree with Representative Carlos Mariani about including both the institutions in this bill and create a path for it. This is one of the first bills that I carried as a freshman legislator. You know, so often we talk about the importance of having an effective teacher in the classroom, which is really important, but it's also important to have an effective principal in the building and in a place where we're moving our principals from not just facilitating or maintaining a building, but looking at how they can create great teachers, but also see the possibilities in every student to create better outcomes. So I support this bill, and I hope we can move it. Thank you.
Representative Seltzer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just very briefly, whenever a school district that I represent comes to testify before us, I always have to comment. And having served on the Hopkins School Board and having both my children going through the Hopkins School District, I know that Hopkins has always been at the forefront of promoting excellent academic leadership, and I'm just very happy to see them continuing in that.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Fenton, thank you. I would just like a little bit of a clarification as a someone who's worked a lot in organization development, strategic planning. Item 2 of 115, 1.15, 1.16, the visioning of the school, and we've talked about the principal to having leadership roles in the building, leading teachers and the school, aligning with the community and the district priorities, all that's fine. I'm just curious about how the implementation of utilizing strategic thinking. That line kind of catches me as pretty open-ended, and just curious about how that would happen.
Ms. Bickel, did you want to answer that?
Madam Chair. The way that we approach that is we actually use a strategic thinking framework. The NISL curriculum is a program that was developed with $11 million in R&D from the Broad Foundation, brought together the areas of business, education, and the military to have an overall view of strategic thinking sort of writ large, and then what does that look like in terms of alignment from the classroom, building, district, and community, ultimately. That's how we approach it.
Closing comments, Representative Finn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So as the nature of schooling is constantly evolving, ongoing professional development is an essential driving force in providing the highest quality education for all students. So I ask that you move this so we can get it fully funded. And I look forward to working with all of our partners involved and input from Representative Mariani as well. So thank you so much.
Thank you, everyone who came to support this and to raise some very interesting and absolutely necessary concerns. With that, the chair renews the motion that 643 as amended be referred to the Committee on Education Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, no. The motion prevails, and the bill is on its way to Education Finance. Representative Erdahl, House File 982, I think you have a testifier here who must testify this morning. Remember, members, we will continue, we will recess and continue this committee hearing tonight at 6 o'clock in room 200. And at that time, we'll hear the rest of Erdahl's 982, add 244, and finish with Representative Wills' bill. And Representative Erdahl, will you move 982 to be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I move House File 982 to be possibly included in an omnibus bill.
Will you explain briefly so we can hear from your testifier? Rules comes in here at 10, and as members know, they jam the doors, and it's hard to get in and out. So just be aware of that, everyone in the room.
You know, we can maybe do this so quickly that in 10 minutes we could just be done.
Oh, that'd be wonderful.
We'll give it a try.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you. Now, Madam Chair, House File 982 addresses problems with the transfer of credits for PSEO students. There's inconsistency in how credits are treated. Under this bill, a high school student who receives a PSEO credit in a course taught by an accredited MNSCU instructor in a MNSCU class may transfer that credit to another MNSCU institution if they so desire. Credits do not always transfer. This results in waste of revenue for the state of Minnesota and the student. It also wastes time and effort for the student. Students rely on the state. They trust that the effort put into a class will be rewarded. Their trust should be justified. If a student puts in the time and effort and is successful, he or she should be rewarded, and the post-secondary credit should follow. They shouldn't have to negotiate. Now, a study will come out next month on credit transfers between 2- and 4-year institutions. This is mainly about PSEO. MNSCU has raised questions about Subdivision 3, page 2, and so I will work on this language with them before the next stop for this bill.
Thank you, Representative Erdahl. And will you please introduce yourself for the record and begin?
Yes, for the record, my name is Kaylee Schoonmaker. I'm the president of the Minnesota State College Student Association. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak today. The MSCSA, the Minnesota State College Student Association, represents nearly 200,000 public, community, and technical college students across Minnesota. In recent years, our students have consistently placed three issues on the top of our association's legislative agenda, and they are college affordability, credit transfer, and access to and information about PSEO. The bill before you now, HF 982, addresses all of those issues in some manner, and we're thankful to Representative Erdahl for bringing this legislation forward. Our association does not have an official position on this particular bill, but we do certainly support the idea, and we wanted to offer our thanks to the committee for having a discussion around the importance of PSEO and credit transfer. When a student takes a course, PSEO or otherwise, they expect it will be meaningful for them in the pursuit of a college degree. The need for this type of certainty in a student's academic career has become even more critical now that our students at public two-year institutions are paying the third highest tuition and fees when compared to like institutions across the country. Simply, when students lose credits and transfer, it increases their cost significantly and delays progress toward a degree. With an increased need for well-trained workers, it's more crucial than ever for our state to have an affordable higher education system, especially at the community and technical college level, where our campuses reach every corner of this state and are accessible to everyone. HF 982 attempts to address the issue of students losing credits when they complete PSEO classes. For these students, the opportunity to receive college credit at no cost to them is a significant draw into PSEO. And for me, as a student that went through PSEO, it was really an opportunity that I needed to realize that I did want to further my education. If students lose credits due to transfer issues, they will be forced to retake courses, and the savings they would have otherwise realized will be negated. MSCSA continues to believe that seamless credit transfer will help students move through to a degree without unnecessary obstacles that can sometimes discourage students from continuing their education or slow their progress and increase costs, adding to debt levels that are already often burdensome for years after graduation. HF 982 brings forward an important discussion, and we're thankful to be a part of this hearing. Madam Chair, members, thank you again for the opportunity to address you, and I'd be happy to stand for any questions.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question for Representative Erdahl. I see in the bill, and I know I might even be a co-author on the bill. I forget.
Sure, you are. You're on.
If I'm not, I should be. Right.
Yes.
Your directive to MNSCU. Often, when we direct MNSCU, we encourage the university to do things. Is this an area where we could encourage the university to be cooperative with high school students who are trying to earn college credits and accept credits from other accredited higher education institutions as well?
You know, Representative Dabney, before he answers, I had the incorrect motion. We need to re-refer this to the Committee on Higher Ed. So okay. Representative Nornes's committee will receive this. But go ahead and answer the question, Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Dabney. that's certainly something that we could look at doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we really can't tell the U of M to do much, but we can encourage, and you know that's it could be something we look at. But frankly, that language about encouraging MNSCU is particularly with the common naming and numbering convention. Mm-hmm. That's a little bit problematic to MNSCU, and I'll be discussing that with them how to work. That's the. They did not express objections except for some questions on that last subdivision. So, yes, we can look at that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Erdahl, maybe we could threaten to take away their ability to sell beer at the stadium again. That seemed to get their attention for a couple of years.
Okay. We'll work on that.
Good idea, Representative Dabney. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Erdahl. I support the whole concept of this bill. Credit where credit is due. I have a little concern, and maybe this is something more appropriate for the Higher Education Committee, but I have some concerns about students taking classes at the university level and not being, you know, they do okay. My students took advantage of some of these classes, and it was really, really an advantage. So I know that it can help a lot of kids and a lot of families and move education along at an appropriate level. But I do have concerns when kids aren't incredibly successful. So they pass the class and they get the credit, mm-hmm.
But are they then prepared for higher level classes? Are they really ready, and particularly at a younger age, a year or two younger, are they really academically and emotionally mature enough to manage?
Representative Erdahl, do you want to tackle that one?
Well, I can tackle it quickly here. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Ward, I mean, you bring up a much broader subject area here. And frankly, I was never a real big PSEO fan over the years. But the fact is, it does exist, and let's do those things that we can do to make it as successful and as good for the students as we can. In the fact that it's before us, we have it. Let's make it work. But I do share some of those concerns that you have, but they're not in the purview of what we can do with this.
Members, we're going to hold this bill over to tonight. Thank you very much to our students.
Well, maybe they have no other questions.
But there are more questions on the list here. But members, we need to put our materials back in the folders so we're ready for tonight. We're going to go into recess and reconvene at 6 o'clock in room 200. So make sure you have your materials back in the packets. And we'll begin tonight, Representative Yarusso, with your question. And Representative Whalen, you have one too. With that, this meeting is recessed.